even if you were a comparatively cosmopolitan family, as my family was simply not a part of cuisine. I have just one recollection of how alien that was in Britain, was of hearing of a young anthropologist that I meet from the United States who went to do field work amongst the Durham miners, and she made her host, with whom she was staying, a spaghetti bolognese, and being very polite Durham people, they thanked her for it, but afterwards fumigated the house.
It wasn't just Durham miners who regarded spag bol with suspicion. Back in the 50s, foreign food was, well, foreign. And for much of the population, eating out was a ritual they avoided. There was the expense, the unreliable quality of the food, and for a class-ridden society, the sheer panic of wondering which knife to use. Young people had a limited number of social venues.
From Quill's Folly, Balham's famous beauty spot, which stands nearly 10 feet above sea level, the town is spread below us in a fairyland of glittering lights, changing all the time. Green, amber, red, red and amber, and back to green. The nightlife is awakening. The El Morocco Tea Room.
Hi, miss.
Yes, what you want?
Pilchards.
They're off, dear.
Baked beans?
Off.
Oh, meatloaf salad?
That's off, too.
Pot of tea?
No tea, dear.
Well, just milk, then.
Milk's off.
Roll and butter, then?
No butter, dear.
Oh, just a roll.
Only bread, love.
I might have just as well have stayed at home.
Well, I don't know. It does you good to have a fling occasionally.
Gradually, tea rooms were supplanted by coffee bars, which were much more in tune with the tastes of 50s teenagers. But even there, the food consisted largely of cheese rolls. There were wimpy bars and trattorias, but few other places to go for cheap, reliable, tasty food in stylish surroundings. Until, that is, a businessman called Peter Boizo began travelling in Italy. There he had developed a taste for Naples' answer to the Welsh rarebit, the pizza. Back in London he looked in vain for his favourite dish, until one day he found a trattoria called Osteria Romana.
We went there one evening because they had pizza on the menu. And remember, Italian restaurants thought that pizza was very much a peasant dish. And I was with a friend of mine, Lord Norbury, and his then fiancée, and we had been looking for pizzas for a long time, and every time I say, well, I'll open a pizzeria one day. So Anne, his wife, said, well, you're always saying you're going to open a pizzeria, why don't you do it? And I asked the proprietor of the Osteria Romana, I said, why is it that you cannot really find pizzas in London? And he said, well, to make a proper pizza, you need a proper pizza oven. He said it was tried a few years ago by Mario Zampi. And Mario Zampi was the man, you'll recall, who directed the early Peter Sellers films. And he set up a place called, believe it or not, Pizza Express, at 29 Water Street in 1960. And he said to all his film stars, the Sophia Lorenz and the Gina Lollobrigidas and others, hey, come along to my restaurant, have a pizza. And I suppose he said, what, we don't want a pizza, you know, we want something proper to eat. You bring us to London and give us a pizza.
Despite the fact that Zampi's project had proved an abject failure, Boizo was fired with enthusiasm.
It so happened, a couple of days later, I was going over to Rome. And when I landed in Rome, I went to one of the little restaurants and I said, could you tell me where you get those ovens from? And the chap gave me the address of a Signor Notaro out in the outskirts of Rome. I jumped into a taxi, went over to see Signor Notaro, said, I would like to set up a pizzeria in London. Can I buy an oven from you? And he said, well, of course. He said, I think pizzas would go very well. I'll help you to do it, you see. So I bought the oven, which I remember cost £600, came back to England, said to Pearlie Norbury, Pearlie, I've bought an oven. I'm going to go into this pizza business. Now I've got to find somewhere to put the oven when it arrives.
At this point, one has to consider whether Boizo was an inspired businessman or a maniac. For he decided to buy Mario Zampi's old restaurant for £100, and in doing so to take on debts of around £14,000. In July 1965, the optimistic Boiso opened his Pizza Express at 29 Wardour Street in Soho, with its classic 60s modern look.
As it was the time of the Purple Hearts in Soho, I thought all these dingy little places up and down Water Street needed brightening up. So I put all fluorescent tubes concealed and masked with eggshell stuff, crating. I put that round the roof. I painted the whole place white and had this, eventually got this pizza oven in, which was a hell of a job to get that in because we had to take the side of the shop out to get it through the into the shop.
I think there's a sort of genius behind Pizza Express. I mean, there's plenty of good, cheap Italian food around and trattorias across the country at the same time. Albeit they had lots of Italian kit, Chianti bottles and beaten brass and all that, were doing the same thing. They were very cheap and very merry. But Pizza Express was modern and bright, and you felt glamorous in it.
Emily Green, a food writer for The Independent. At first, Boiso thought it would look more glamorous for everyone to stand, as was the tradition in Italian pizzerias. But he soon discovered that his customers then declined to eat, preferring instead to lounge at the bar, consuming vast quantities of Coca-Cola. Chairs and tables soon appeared.
People said in England, well, you've got to have somewhere for people to sit down. You can't just have them standing up eating pizza out of their hands like that. So as a concession, I put in these tables. But I was very reluctant to get involved in washing up. So I found a supplier of plastic knives and forks and paper plates. So I give them this little white plastic knife and fork. It'd stick it into the pizza, and lo and behold, the fork would melt. Because, plastic was in its early days, I suppose. So that wasn't very good. And reluctantly, I had to go to Woolworths and buy some knives and forks and start washing up.
Boiso had created a magic moment in the history of eating out by putting together modernity, cheapness, and reliable quality. But other restaurants had played their part in the revolution.
Quite a lot is owed the trattoria, and quite a lot is owed the Indian restaurant in making it kind of casual and affordable. Because these places were on just about every high street with their Chianti bottles and their furry tigers and their flocked wallpapers and things. But the food was affordable and it had big flavors. And people loved this. Just the fact that it had big flavors, that it tasted of something they responded to. And maybe now they're finding those flavors a bit crude, but they were terribly important at the time.
I find it fascinating. I think the reason for the rise in those ethnic cuisines is because they were seen as being cheap alternatives to what people thought was proper food. Chinese meals and Indian meals were always cheaper. I've always had this theory that if you offer the average British person a £2.95 T-bone steak or a 45-piece sausage roll, most of them would go for the 45-piece sausage roll, not because it represented better value, because if you can get a T-bone steak for £2.95, you're doing really well. But the British would opt for the sausage roll just because it was the cheaper alternative.
That was Bob Payton, an American who is recolonizing Britain with U.S. restaurants. Tim May, the chairman of a design consultancy, thinks the British love affair with Asian cuisine has disreputable motives.
There have always been those people from colonial countries who were prepared to come and do our dirty jobs, like working in kitchens and serving in restaurants and bars. Perhaps we feel it's relatively easy to go into an Indian restaurant because we don't have to treat the people with any particular respect. Now, that's a sinister and nasty reflection, but there may be some truth in it. That it's relatively easy to go and patronise the Chinese and the Indians because they're just Chinese and Indians.
If the British patronised Asian restaurants because they were relatively classless, it's easy to explain the success of the burger as the ultimate classless snack. And after all, British snack food was pretty uninspired, as Bob Payton points out.
To me, perhaps the most disgusting culinary treat, and I tell all of my friends who are in the restaurant business, whether they're cooks or just eaters, about the great British delicacy of a chip butty. And no non-UK person can ever get their minds around, much less their lips around, the concept of French fries on a bun.
No, it's easy. Just, oh well, The British were suckers for that American phenomenon, the meat patty and a bap, as they might, but don't call it in Yorkshire.
One burger I didn't find in the supermarket is the rabbit burger, but we discovered you could buy them cooked from a van in Wales, and Paul Clifford is the man behind the operation. Paul, what in fact is in a rabbit burger? You've brought these in.
Yes, I have. This burger only has rabbit in it. It has no fat at all, no pork. It's very, very low in cholesterol, very, very low in carbohydrate. And there is nothing but rabbit in it.
And your logo is Get the Rabbit Habit.
And have it every week, yes, indeed.
Hi there, this is Arnie Ginsberg telling you that Adventure Car Hop presents, for the first time anywhere, the Ginsburger. That's right, the Ginsburger is now being served at Adventure Car Hop. I designed it, I planned it, I tested it, but you're going to eat it, and what a delicious mouthful this is. And Adventure Car Hop is serving the Ginsburger on a record which you keep for your very own. If you say woo-woo Ginsburg with your order, you get another Ginsburger free of charge. So how can you miss? Stop out to Adventure Car Hop, Route 1 in Saugus.
Thanks, Arnie, but I think I'll just keep on traveling down that old freeway. The burger phenomenon fitted in with a faster lifestyle, a more throwaway society influenced particularly by a torrent of Americana. From Wimpy's, through McDonald's, Burger King's and Wendy's, the hamburger bars have established relations across the nations. Their success with the public speaks for itself, but the food critics aren't so easily seduced.
Well, I loathe them. I loathe them in America and I loathe them here. I think they've got a lot of appeal to some people who kind of have no choice. They have tons of appeal to children because they know a Burger King is a Burger King and it's going to be the same in Nottingham as it is in London, as it is in New York, as it is anywhere else. They know how much they're going to spend. They know that their child can toss an entire Coke over the table and that there won't be any embarrassment. They've been successful simply because they took the trouble out of eating out. They could be a sort of bribe for a lot of screaming kids, but people loved it because it had a sort of family wholesomeness about it.
Do I look 20% smaller to you? I must to McDonald's. When I order a regular burger at McDonald's, they make it with 20% less meat than Burger King. Unbelievable. Luckily, I know perfect way to show McDonald's how I feel. I go to Burger King.
Aren't you hungry for Burger King now?
I don't think they give anything to society besides a quick fix, and I dislike them intensely. A good restaurant will improve the landscape, and these fast food chains do just the opposite.
Bob Payton, the apostle of the upmarket hamburger, sees nothing wrong with marketing to children.
The English have this thing, and it's a hangover from the war. I feel that the British still think that they're paying penance for winning the war, and there's this attitude that rationing has just finished, and you know we shouldn't really eat meat more than once a week. Eating out is not a celebration. In most societies that I know around the world, eating is the focal point of social contact and a celebration of life. And the British celebration of life is somehow not at the dinner table.
Where is the British celebration of life?
Perhaps sitting in front of the television. But it's becoming a celebration of life in restaurants because I think ourselves and other restaurants like our chain have made it easier for families to go out and have made restaurants accessible for children and grandparents to enjoy a casual meal for not a lot of money in nice surroundings with really good service. And you have a good time. There's nothing more exciting to me in a restaurant than the sound of laughter and smiling grandparents doting over their grandchildren, with the parents feeling greatly relieved that they've appeased both ends of the family, their parents and their children. To my mind, the British never used to go out to eat as families because the people who could afford to take their children out to eat sent them away to private school.
Payton began his British crusade following in Boyzo's footsteps, selling pizzas, but in the Chicago deep pan style. Soon he was opening other restaurants, a rib shack here, a Windy City bar and grill there, and a modest little chain called Henry J. Bean's, but his friends all call him Hank. Hank's bars are full of 1930s gasoline signs and photos of old baseball stars. They're places where you can have a full meal, a snack, or just a beer.
My frustration with British pubs was, while you might get a decent pint of beer, the food that went along with it was usually disgusting. It was either overcooked sausages or Cornish pasties or Scotch eggs that had been sitting around for days and days. And my view is that you could make a really good fresh cheeseburger or a good bowl of chili or a nice salad or a chicken sandwich, something that, where you could eat casually, have a nice drink and a nice something to eat at the same time. And again, I made that look like my fantasy of a 1950s American bar, along the lines of Cheers or those places that you saw in Happy Days.
Other delicacies that we sell are things such as the Fred Piot dog, which is actually a hot dog from Kansas City, but it's slightly better than the ones that you get next to the cinema on the street. And we also sell our famous chili dog, which is with the chili sauce on the top.
Peyton should be given credit for his rib shacks and Henry J. Beans because the food is actually a cut above. I find the atmosphere of the places heavily oppressive. To begin with, I feel that everybody is kind of being forced to be nice by rota, that there's a kind of mechanical setup to sort of have a nice day and sort of a enforced jocularity and no sort of natural charm to the place.
If she hates that, she should try another slice of American retro chic. Tim May, the chairman of the Design House Company, took an old wimpy bar in Soho and transformed it into a themed restaurant. Ed's Easy Diner is 50s America.
The very first Ed's Diner is a tiny little place. There's a horseshoe-shaped bar counter with fixed stools around it, I think 21 stools. In the middle of the horseshoe, all the cooking happens in full view of the customers. You can only sit on the stool, and there are no tables. The colours of the place are red and white and lots of neon. It's full of American imagery. And everything about it is as authentic as it can be, right down to the old 1950s vending machines in the place, which all work, and the reconditioned Seberg Wall-O-Matic dime selectors, which are the little jukeboxes which sit on the bar. All of those have been converted from dimes to 5p's. They all work. And part of the fun of the place is that you're not just having a hamburger, but you're enjoying the whole experience of an American diner of the late 1950s. And in that sense, it's a theatrical experience, and it's a deliberate piece of full-blooded nostalgia.
Easy Diner in the heart of Soho. We've got two salads, California Cobb salad or a cheese salad. We also have Ed's hot dogs, 100% pure beef, and they come with a choice of grilled onions or sauerkraut. Or you can have chili, cheese, or our striped dog, which is a stripe of mustard and a stripe of ketchup.
Restaurants seem to have become destination points and trendy points where people go to restaurants for something more than food. I guess they go there because they're bored with television or there's not much else to do, perhaps. I don't quite know why. I think many of them don't go there, as I suspect the French do, to go and have a good meal and really enjoy exquisite food with probably interesting conversation as well.
Peter Boyzo's Pizza Expresses keep their 60s modern classicism. It was the theme in tune with the time. Now maybe it's becoming cute. Themes now dominate many up-and-down market eateries, sometimes to the level of farce.
What's claimed to be the country's first CB radio restaurant opened in central London this lunchtime. It's called the Eyeball, and every table is fitted with a CB radio set on which you order your meal. We sent Andrew Turner along to try out the new restaurant and speak to its owner, David Solomons.
A CB restaurant is a meeting place. We call it the Eyeball because Eyeball is CB language for meeting.
Well, I've come in here knowing very little about CB. I've been given a handle of Big Mouth. And I've also had my photograph taken when I came in. Why is that?
Well, this isn't just the facility that we're providing for our customers. The idea is that they have two photographs when they're taken in. One they can take away with our compliments. The other is put up on our display wall at the back there. Simply because when they come in, they can see other CBers, see what they look like. They may well have spoken to them on the airways, and it gives them an opportunity to see who they've been talking to.
So if they want to know what Big Mouth looks like, they just look on the notice board.
Absolutely.
Right, well, I'll have a try on my microphone of ordering my meal. I think I've got to say 1-4 for restaurant, copy.
Yeah, copy. The breaker there off of a restaurant. You've got the Eyeball Bistro chef here. What can we do for you, back?
How about goldenrod, breaker, chick and eyeball potatoes, 10-4.
Yeah, roger D. Give us 5 minutes and we'll have that on the table. Stand by, 10-10.
I think I'll miss that pit stop too. For more serious posers, you can't beat a brasserie. They began to appear in Britain in the 80s, and one of the first was the Soho Brasserie, designed, again, by Tim May.
A proper brasserie, in the way that they know them in France, definitely has two spaces. It has a front bar, very close to the street. You can get to it straight off the street, no more than 2 or 3 steps. The bar is higher than a typical English pub bar, and you lean on it, standing up with your elbow akimbo, rather than sitting at it. And people basically drink all sorts of things, from coffee through to beer and wine. And they can get a simple snack, a croque monsieur, a sandwich, or a plate of salami. Then the back room is where the patron eats, as well as his customers. And that's like going into the patron's parlour and sitting down and having a proper meal. Most of the brasseries at the time he was designing the Soho Brasserie only had restaurant licenses. So although they looked the part, you couldn't use them in the informal way that you can the Soho Brasserie, because they had the wrong sort of license. You couldn't drink without eating. So with the Soho Brasserie, we think we created one of the first, if not the first, proper brasseries in the UK.
Brasserie now has to have a combination of menus. Ideally at the Soho Brasserie, we have two menus which run. A simple bar menu, where you have the French onion soup, the warm chicken salad. These are all very successful. Chicken just pan fried with ginger and coriander, served on a bit of lettuce. Meanwhile, in the back restaurant, it really is more restaurant style. We have certain Thai dishes. We have fish cakes with a Thai sauce. They normally retail about £5.50 to £6. So it's a very affordable price. I mean, a beef burger in a fast food restaurant would cost the same. I mean, these are freshly made from salmon, made on the premises, fried and served with either tartar sauce or this bit of Thai sauce or sesame honey. A fish cake might not appear to be a creative thing, but like I say, with a brasserie, you take a concept and you either adapt it or take it one step further, so it's not a frozen fish cake.
I think it's nightmarish. It's a deeply uncomfortable place. I should confess I've only spent a matter of minutes in it because I've reeled out in dismay every time I've gone in. I think they probably mean well, but they're trying to do the whole thing by numbers. I mean, they're actually done out with the proper fittings, but then they'll blast pop music at you.
Another 80s development in the eating out was the food court, which now flourishes up and down the land in shopping centres, railway stations and airports. Here the customer can choose from a range of kiosks serving fast pasta, fast chop suey, fast chicken tikka, and all as the muzak plays on. Robbie Guild has designed many of Britain's food courts.
It's great family eating. If your little son wants a burger and your daughter wants a pizza, there's no more family arguments anymore because they can both have exactly what they want and still eat as a family.
St John's Food Court in the heart of St John's Shopping Centre, which is one of the major shopping centres within the Liverpool area. Here at the food court we've got seating for 420 people. We sell everything from just a cup of coffee through to a full roast meal if necessary. We've got the biggest baked potatoes in town. We've got fish and chips. We've got Chinese meals cooked to order. We've got American ice creams and cookies. We've got homemade sandwiches and pastries. We've got pancakes. We've got burgers. We've got everything you can think of that you would like to eat.
done a study tour around America, and most shopping centres in America have a food court, and they're very different and very varied. One of the interesting things about Americans is they eat all day long. They call it grazing. And because of that, a large percentage of their shopping is dedicated to food, a lot more than it is in the UK. And they're very large because of it. There's a food court in St. Louis in Union Station that has about 40 different operations that range from frozen daiquiris to Greek food to sesame seed buns, submarines, which are like big French roll sandwiches. There's a rather nasty one that's been going now for about 3 years called Dog on a Stick. And it's basically a frankfurter on a lollipop stick that's deep fried. Very, very horrible.
With Dog on a Stick, have we reached the end of the line? What other cuisines and styles are there left to loot? Tim May helped launch retro chic themed restaurants, brasserie culture, and has designed Europe's biggest tapas bar, another big growth area. So what's next?
One of the great unrealized opportunities is, I suppose, that great British invention, the sandwich. Almost every other country in Europe makes more of the sandwich than we do, and we invented it. So there's a whole approach to informal eating that the British are, in theory, quite good at, but which gets degenerated into pub grub. And even the most cursory analysis of pub grub shows that it's third-class ethnic food. I mean, the average pub grub menu comprises pizza, lasagna, spaghetti, moussaka. I mean, where's the English food? Now, good cheese, good sausages, good sandwiches. At that level, it's perfectly possible to do good English food.
Is this where we came in? One step beyond Balham, gateway to the south. Are we a nation in chains? Peter Boyzo's empire stretches across the country these days, and is centred on the old Soho restaurant Kettner's, where royalty dined in the last century. If they returned today, they'd feast on pizzas. And in Leicestershire, Bob Payton is running his latest venture, serving burgers in a country house hotel. Chains are everywhere. Whatever the critics might say, surely it's better than the Al Morocco tea room. Emily Green.
What's wrong with it is it makes the world a slightly dull and predictable place to be. You want people to run restaurants that have a great deal of kind of spark and personality, and not to have people saying have a nice day because they're paid to, and people cooking burgers because they're paid to. It's shocking. You have cooks who don't even buy their own food. It's sent to them from a purchasing office. Now, can you imagine the pride you would take in your work if you're just cooking something that was loaded off a lorry every morning for you?
Guido challenges you to the blindfold test. Eat a piece of Guido's pizza and then eat a blindfold. See if you can tell the difference.
I think, actually, eating's all about choice. What I love about eating is that if I'm at home and we decide to go out to dinner, then the first question is, what type of food? Where in the world do I want to go to for this evening? I find that whole idea of variety of food, whether it be fast food, such as in a shopping centre environment, or whether it be high street restaurants or tucked away in Muse restaurants, I think it's the variety that's exciting. And as time goes by, there's more and more variety. It's not long since, for instance, all you would see is a Chinese restaurant. Nowadays, you start asking the question, do you want Sichuan Chinese, do you want Peking Chinese, do you want Cantonese-style Chinese food? And we're becoming so much more sophisticated and knowledgeable about the variety of foods that are available, and that I find that exciting.